Welcome one, welcome all. Thanks for joining us today. This is Town Call, a brand new approach to homegrown radio where you are the star, you are the talent, and you will drive the talking points of the day. If you'd like to participate in today's forum, give us a call or shoot us a text, 844-967-2789. I'm William Walter, Policy Research Director and Lead Training Organizer with Our Wisconsin Revolution, with Aaron on the board and special guest today, John Shelton. How are we doing today, gentlemen?
William, I'm doing great. Happy to be celebrating this 4th of July week, and our celebration of democracy and what makes us Americans. This is a great week.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, how are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well as well. Trying to figure out the dumpster fire that is Twitter and Threads and all that nonsense. And so we'll see how this all goes.
Yeah, save your mental health, Aaron, and don't worry. Twitter will be gone in like 6 months anyway.
Yeah, you're right.
Running it into the ground. but to give you a brief introduction, Professor Shelton is a friend of the show. We are launching our new segment, Office Hours, with Professor John Shelton today. The professor is in. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns you would like to share with the class, Professor Shelton will be here to answer. Give us a call, 844-967-2789. And John, give us a could you give us a reintroduction to yourself? I know you are the professor. You are a professor at UW-Green Bay and the chair of Democracy and Justice Studies, as well as the author of The Education Myth, How Human Capital Turned Social Democracy. How Human Capital Trumped Social Democracy, excuse me. And you are the Vice President of Higher Education for American Federation of Teachers Wisconsin. Give us a little more details on who Professor Shelton is.
Yeah, so I, by trade, I'm a historian. I study U.S. labor and working class history, history of American education, history of American politics. All those things are obviously pretty closely related to each other. I really do think that being a professor means that you should be engaged in, some of the big debates of our time. So, I rep my local faculty and staff union as the president of UW-Green Bay United, and then serve in the state federation level, as you just mentioned. We have, different constituencies in AFT Wisconsin, right? We're all educator unions, but my constituency is higher ed. So I've been elected to, this is my fourth term serving as vice president for higher education for AFT Wisconsin. Super proud of that and the work that I've been able to do with locals all across the state, and then involved in Green Bay politics too. So I was appointed to the first ever Green Bay Equal Rights Commission, which I'm really proud of, and we've done a lot of good work there. I could there's other stuff I could talk about, but those are kind of the bullet point highlights.
Putting your time and effort where your mouth is. That's what I like to see. Actions speak louder than words. And we have had John on in the past to discuss the education myth. And I think that particularly with what's going on in the state of Wisconsin right now with the budget and the funding cuts to the UW system, as well as at the national level with student loan debts, which we will touch on throughout the course of the show. This idea is really coming to the forefront right now, how important it is to focus on our youth, how important it is to kind of protect them from the predatory system that we see around us. So that'll be my first question for you, John. Obviously, we saw the Supreme Court last week, as we discussed, in a 6-3 decision rejecting Biden's proposal to cut student loan debt for millions of American students. This is going to have wide-ranging implications across not just the day-to-day life of millions of Americans, but I think the economy as a whole, when you're taking $200, $300, $400, $500, $600 a month and expecting people that had that to as spending money, basically, they had the ability to go out and use this money in their local communities and really help the local economy. Instead, it's going to be shoved down the throats of predatory lenders. This is going to have a monumental impact on students across the country. What are you seeing with your students in particular that might really come to the forefront in the coming months and years?
Yeah, well, one thing I just want to correct you on quickly, William, is that the way that the student loan system works is it's actually the government, that the Department of Education, that loans us the money, right? So the government turns a profit actually from student loans. Used to be predatory banks, but that changed under the Obama administration. That was one thing that the Obama administration did, was to push the Department of Education to take on at least public loans, right? If you're taking out loans from a private lender, yeah, you might be dealing with some predatory lenders. But you know, the student loan thing, right? I think for a lot of young people, and this would have been transformative for a lot of people, right? $10,000 forgiveness for most borrowers, and $20,000 if for anybody who received Pell grants, right? And so the way Pell grants work is they're based on income. So these would have been people who had fewer financial resources going into college, who would have ostensibly have probably more debt now, right? So this would be a transformative thing. You know, and so I think a lot of younger people right now are feeling like, you know, they had this real opportunity held in front of them and then kind of taken away. And I know for a lot of younger folks, the younger generations in this country, especially folks, you know, in that sort of decade coming out of college, many of them, it just feels like you don't really have anybody on your side, you know, when the government is taking these things away. And I think it really fits into how a lot of younger people were feeling about the Dobbs decision last year, right? That took away reproductive rights from all women, of course, but I think younger women really felt that pretty intensely. And so, you know, you saw this manifest at the ballot box in our state Supreme Court race. So this is, I think, another thing that young people are hearing, that, like, you know, we have a federal government, and in this case, a conservative Supreme Court, that's sort of out of touch with what it is that young people need. But if I could say one other thing about this, I'm a little frustrated with the Biden administration as far as this goes, because, you know, I think it was a good idea to try to eliminate the amount of debt that they did, and they might still be able to do it down the road, actually, because the law was struck down, or the court decision struck down the efforts to eliminate the debt based on the sort of emergency powers, you know, of the crisis of the pandemic. And so it's
possible Biden administration overstepped their authority.
So it's possible the Biden administration could make the argument later that, like, we're going to do this, but do it under the Higher Education Act and our authority as effectively the person administering these loans more broadly. But the thing that frustrated me about this is that, you know, if you're going to eliminate some of the loans, why not eliminate everybody's loans, right? Like, to me, this is where the Democratic Party ends up sometimes, not all Democrats, of course, but in this particular instance, engaging in these half measures that they think are going to placate people, but they still got all of the criticism from the right, and the law still got struck down, right? So it's like, if you're going to try to do something to help working people in this country, go big, right? Go big and you know, make it a universal program. That's what I'd like to see. And then the other thing that this speaks to, too, is this wedge, and I get into this in the book, right, that you noted, this wedge, this false dichotomy that has been forced on us, that you know, only people with college degrees are going to get certain things and people without aren't going to get them. You know, the eliminating student loan debt should be in the context of ensuring that everybody has economic security, whether they have a college degree or not. So if you wanted to create a package of legislation that would, you know, eliminate everybody's student loan debt forever, let's make higher education free. But let's also combine that with a jobs guarantee and labor rights, so that whether you have a college degree or not, you know you're going to have a good job. And that will help stem the resentment that clearly was kind of drummed up in part of this, especially the way the right talked about this, right? That college graduates were getting something that everybody else wasn't getting.
Mm-hmm. And no half measures is exactly, that's the perfect way to phrase it, because that's exactly what I was going to say when you noted that Democrats are, they're trying to kind of play both sides, in the sense that they're helping their base because we're giving you student loan relief, but we're not going to eradicate all of it because that's not fair, and all that kind of stuff. When in reality, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that $10,000 or $20,000 isn't incredibly helpful for people who are swimming in mountains and mountains of debts. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, most college students have significantly higher debt than that. And if you're getting rid of some of the problem, why not just tackle the entire issue? Why not hit at the root of the issue itself? Something else that I'd like to touch on that you just brought up, and we talked about it a little bit before the show, is how all of these issues are kind of intertwined, particularly in regards to the budget. When we just saw that the budget cut $32 million for the UW system, and I think that, you know, as you noted, this is going to force the universities to increase tuition across the board, which means that you're going to have to take out larger student loans to be able to pay for the education that my generation grew up being told you are going to need if you want to be successful, as we touched on in the past. I don't understand how a lot of elected officials can complain about the cost of higher education and then turn around and make a decision like this, which will only lead to even higher increases in the cost of education.
Well, we're not going to be able to cover this all before the break, but I'll get started with it, okay? So the first thing that you have to recognize is that Republicans in the legislature have an ideological reason to try and defund the UW system, okay? It's not that they don't want to have other kinds, you know, students to have access to higher education, but they believe that what's happening in our classrooms is that we are supposedly indoctrinating students, right? In things that, you know, in topics that they don't actually want to learn about and that are threatening to Republicans who want to retain the kind of hierarchies that exist in this state, right? So when you looked at some of the things that the Assembly Speaker Robin Voss was saying about the UW system, when he, you know, sort of, he's not on the Joint Finance Committee, but he was kind of obviously like overseeing the effort of the JFC to put this $32 million cut to the UW system in the budget and to push for the elimination of hundreds of positions that are connected to diversity, equity, and inclusion, right? Which all DEI is you know, helping to think, it's helping students to think about how race, gender, sex, sexuality, and class impact our society, right? And impact students' ability to be successful. I mean, actually, like veteran services falls within the orbit of DEI. So,
you know, every Fortune 500 company has their own DEI statements. They teach trainings on it. Like, they recognize the importance of this in modern society.
Right. Even that sort of like really thin, like neoliberal version that you get from these Fortune 500 companies, for sure. But Voss and the Republicans don't want that. Voss actually said, I'm embarrassed to be a UW graduate. And now this is funny because he's a graduate of UW-Whitewater in political science and public relations, I think. And you think about how he's using what he's learned to actually carry out these sorts of things, right? My colleague Neil Krause and I wrote an op-ed about this in the Cap Times, people can check out. You know, so he's got this like bizarre animus, and it's extended to a lot of the Republicans. And of course, it's caught up in things that are happening nationally, where what they actually want, they accuse us of indoctrination, but actually that's what they want to do. They want to create this very narrow paradigm around which students can learn things. And that's what they want our universities to do. And so they're basically saying like, no, we're going to punish you unless you stop teaching this giving students access to this like really broad education, you know, where they learn about race and gender and all these things that we know are important and that students really want to learn about.
It's projection all the way down, John. Good point. We're talking with Professor John Shelton today. This is Office Hours on Town Call. If you have a question for the professor, give us a call, 844-967-2789. We'll see you right after the break. Welcome one, welcome all, welcome back. This is Town Call, a brand new approach to homegrown radio. If you'd like to participate in today's forum, give us a call or shoot us a text, 844-967-2789. Today we are holding office hours with Professor John Shelton. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns you'd like to share with the class, please reach out. Professor Shelton is here to answer them. And John, before the break, we were talking about kind of how a lot of these issues intertwine, particularly in regards to the budget, the cutting of funding to the UW system and student loans. And something that I'd like to hear from you then is, what would you advise as the best course of action that Governor Tony Evers should have taken in regards to the funding cuts at the budget level?
Yeah, so I think everybody I hear from in the UW system is pretty frustrated right now because, you know, I'll go out on a limb and say almost all of us supported Governor Evers in both of his election campaigns. And, you know, especially in his re-election campaign, you know, it was a pretty resounding win, right? Last year.
91,000 votes. That's a Wisconsin yep. landslide.
And I think a lot of us feel like, okay, we're winning these statewide elections. What people are actually voting for is a fully funded education system, whether that's K-12 or UW. And so it means like, you don't compromise on things like vouchers, which Evers of course did in the you know in the negotiations over Milwaukee, and revenue for Milwaukee, you know, because we're winning these elections and public education is something that we should all be protecting and actually making a deeper commitment to. So I think people were frustrated by that, but then in terms of the UW system, I mean, this we're getting a cut here. And we've had over a decade of austerity in this state, you know, and combined with a tuition freeze until very recently means that students just aren't able to get all of the things that they need, right? I mean, they can't get all the support services. You know, we have fewer faculty now in the UW system than we did like 15 years ago. We have more students, you know, and so what we need is actually an infusion of funds to fully fund the UW system and make sure students have what they need. What we're getting is continued austerity here over this pretext about DEI. And, you know, what this means is that students are going to have to continue to do with less, or the UW system is going to have to raise tuition. The Board of Regents just raised tuition 5%. And, you know, that's barely keeping up with the inflation we've had over the past few years. So students could be looking at more tuition increases, right? So you think about how that connects to something like student loan debt, and they're also hearing from the federal government, no, we're not going to do anything for you. That looks pretty bleak. And, you know, I think you're starting to hear this from a lot of young people. And, you know, what I heard from a lot of people in terms of this entire budget is that there's really not very much in there that warranted Evers signing the budget. I mean, it's great that he used the line item veto to get rid of the proposal to eliminate all the DEI positions. I mean, that's of course something that he should have done, and I'm glad that he did that. But I think he should have vetoed the budget in its entirety and gone to the Republicans and said, come back with something that actually funds education in this country, because in our state, because this is something that's too valuable, and we've let it go underfunded for too long, both at the K-12 and the higher education level. And, you know, we're going to do something about that. And if you're not going to come back, then we're just going to continue with the funding that we've had for the past couple of years, because there's so many things that are underfunded. Childcare providers are going to go out of business because the Republicans refuse to extend the funding that is necessary for a lot of childcare providers to keep going. So you add it all up and it's like, you know, again, we're winning these elections. When people voted to elect Evers last year, what they were saying is, these are the values we want you to fight for. And to me, it seems like this is settling for far less than we need to settle for, you know?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good point, John. And actually, to our listeners, if you didn't get a chance to listen to yesterday's episode, we had Colin McNamara on. He's 23 years old, running for state Senate in Senate District 24. And we basically had that exact conversation, John. And young people are losing interest in the system. They're becoming apathetic because they're not seeing results. Though a lot of them do still care, how do we drive this engagement? How do we kind of reinvigorate their love and passion for their communities? John, I see a lot of hands in the audience, so we're going to get some questions from the class. First, we have Mark from Prairie du Sac. Mark, what's your question for the professor today?
Well, what I'd like to know is, why is it that me, you know, just a provincial boy from northern Wisconsin, getting an accounting degree, and I'm 65 years old and studied a little bit more of like the founding principles of our government in the Federalist Papers and such, know that like Josh Hawley is full of crap when he says, oh, this country is founded on Christianity and Judaism and that is just absolute nonsense. If that is the case, then why can't the president just declare a day of jubilee and cancel all debt, you know, whatever kind of debt it is, that's in the biblical canon. But I mean that part of government in Wisconsin Constitution as well as the federal constitution is to promote the general welfare. And I think that's what the governor and people opposing the current version of the Republican Party is that apparently the Republican Party does not give a rat's ass about promoting the general welfare anymore. I mean that it's of interest to note that in the Confederate Constitution, the general welfare is not mentioned as part of when they're founding principles in the Confederate Constitution, nor is the common defense in the Confederate Constitution. So,
Mark, what is your question for the professor?
How do we engage people and convince them in these red districts that they're doing themselves a disservice by voting for these fools that are taking away from them and convincing these people you don't deserve any more, you know, that as long as we have more people to get less, that it's hard for me to wrap my mind around where these Republicans are coming from these days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thoughts, Professor?
Yeah, Mark, thanks for the call. I mean, you make so many interesting points. There's like so many things I could talk about, but I did want to just talk about one thing quickly, which was, you know, this argument of Josh Hawley and these other, you know, folks that our nation was founded on Christian principles. Absolutely untrue, right? I mean, one of the look at the First Amendment, of course, but, you know, one of the sort of major interventions of the American Revolution was this push from Thomas Jefferson and others. Good week to be talking about Thomas Jefferson, right? With all the contradictions, slave owner, et cetera. But you know, one of the big innovations of the American Revolution was the separation of church and state. We are not a nation founded on Christian principles. We are a nation founded on the idea of Republican democracy, and that, you know, people have the right to practice religion. They have the right to conscience. They have the right to free thought. But you can't impose religious belief on anybody. And that's one of the bedrock foundations of our nation. And that is very much worth celebrating this week. So I'm glad you brought that up. Now, in terms of what we do to get folks in this country, you know, to think about, you know, their own interests and get excited about not vote against, you know, frankly, too many Republicans that really aren't fighting for the economic security of the people in their own districts. You know, I think we're in a existential fight right now to determine what the principles of American democracy are. And for too long, those of us on the left, I don't mean us in this conversation, but I mean the center left, Democrats, largely at the national level, have pushed for a view of economics that it's neoliberal, right? It says we're going to open things up to the marketplace and individual initiative, and that's going to solve all of our problems. That's been an utter disaster. And one of the things that's happened is that Republican populists who actually have no ideas to improve the lives of most working Americans. Think about Trump, right? He was going to just like berate corporate leaders and get them to bring jobs back to the United States. That doesn't work, right? The only thing that works is by ensuring that the government, which, as you mentioned, right, should be there to promote the general welfare, that's right in the Constitution, to ensure that the government of we the people is actually doing things to make we the people our lives better, and not corporations make it more easy for them to exploit us. So that's the existential argument we're having, and we need to make, this is going to sound kind of ironic, but we actually don't need to criticize Republicans to get those folks that you're talking about to not vote for them. What we need to do is come up with a better argument on our side. How is it that we are going to ensure economic security for every person who works in this country? That's how we build the foundation of a stable democracy. That's how we get people voting against the Republicans who are actively trying to undermine our democracy. That's how it has to happen, in my opinion.
I think you need to show them wins too. It's really easy, yeah. To give you an example. I have a friend of mine who I work with very closely. She's an incredible human being, but we were having a conversation about her time growing up. Now she's significantly older than I am. Women couldn't have credit cards when she was a girl, right? And the Democratic Party fought for and got her rights that she did not have available to her. And because of that, they earned her vote, essentially, is what she was saying. And my counter to that was, that's excellent and I'm glad and that makes perfect sense. But I was not alive at that time. That did not impact my life. That did not earn my vote. I hate to make this comparison, but you know how they say in sports all the time, it's a what have you done for me lately type league. That, I think, could be applied to politics as well, in the sense that you can't rest on your laurels. You need to be continuing to improve the lives of your constituents. That is your role as an elected official is to represent the people who chose to elect you. And if you are not continuing to push for them cycle after cycle after cycle, then you cannot expect them to come out and support you cycle after cycle after cycle.
That's 100% right. And you look at the sort of high watermark, in my view, of the Democratic Party in this country, starts in the 1930s with FDR. Election of 1936, which happens after 1935, when you get the Social Security Act, the National Labor Relations Act, which ensures workers' rights to unionize, the Revenue Act, which really kind of initiates a robust system of progressive taxation. All of those things, they're very popular because they literally transformed people's lives. 1936, that's the moment when working people start to vote for a generation for the Democratic Party, because people see them as the party that's actually fighting for working people. And, you know, there's a reason that Democrats dominate national politics from then until about the 1970s, right? It's when Democrats move away from those principles under Carter and others that come after that you start to see Republicans make a lot of headway. This is a country in which people are basically, Democrats, small D Democrats, right, who believe that government should play an active role in making their lives better. That's long been the belief. And it's only when we've moved away from that in our politics that we have these really, really divisive and nasty politics and you know, reactionary Republicans trying to take away our rights.
Mm-hmm. And so we got a couple more hands in the audience. I'm going to go to Karina from Milwaukee. Karina, what is your question for the professor?
My question is, gentlemen. My question is, as far as I understand, and I looked at the student loan forgiveness, it's not the only president who can do that. It's also a minister, the education department. Why wouldn't they get together and give the education department enough a budget to just remove the loans? Because it's hard to take in that military budget is untouchable, and health care budget and education budget is getting wasted practically to nothing. How does it make sense? And when I talk about it with American people, it feels like when they talk about the country, yes, it's their country. They were born here. I wasn't. It's my country today, and I'm a citizen of it. But unfortunately, there's no backing for the people who live here because they don't belong to this land. This is not their motherland. This is so now we can just waste people for
Karina, I think everybody who comes to America, this is a melting pot. This is our land. And we do have the commercial break coming up shortly, but Professor Shelton is going to get to your question right after the break. Don't let anybody tell you that this is not your land. This is all of our land. John, so did you get the question, John?
Oh, yeah, I did. Sorry, I thought we were waiting for the break.
We are. I just want to make sure that we're on the same page. So, yeah. And we're going to have a couple more questions for Professor Shelton after the break. If you have any questions, calls, or concerns for the professor, come on down to office hours. Give us a call, 844-967-2789. We'll be right back after the break.
Your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York.
Welcome, one, welcome all, welcome back. This is Town Call, a brand new approach to homegrown radio. Today we are hosting Office Hours with Professor John Shelton. And John, we're going to go to a bit of a lightning round. We had Karina's question from right before the break, if you want to touch on that quickly.
Yeah, I just want to say quickly that the Biden administration could actually revisit this under the Higher Education Act. It's a little unclear because, the Department of Education has only kind of absolved loans when there were efforts of like malfeasance, right? When there were like predatory lenders and they've completely forgiven loans. So this is something that they could revisit. But I just want to remind folks of something really quick, which is this. We have a Supreme Court that's 66%, two-thirds Republican appointees. Republicans have only won one popular vote election since 1988. I just want people to remember that. Okay.
And that was in 2004 with an incumbent conservative president.
Right. So think about how out of whack the Supreme Court is with what it is that most Americans want.
Mm-hmm. And so we're going to go back to the phone lines. We have Andrea from Menominee Falls. Andrea, what's your question for the professor today?
Hi, thanks for having me. So my question is just a little bit of a pivot, but just thinking about solutions going forward, and I always go back to finding some way to dissolve this us versus them mentality between conservatives and liberals. What are your thoughts on that?
So that's a great question. You know, I think we have to be really clear about what's happening in this country. And I don't actually think most conservative voters want the things that like Republican politicians, at least in Wisconsin, are pushing on them, right? I think those people are Republicans, people like Robin Voss, are using legitimate grievances that people feel with this political system to push them toward things that most Americans don't actually want. If you look at polls, most Americans want things like universal health care. I think almost the majority of Republicans support labor unions, right? But how come these things aren't being manifest in policy, right? It's because politicians are not actually, as something William was talking about earlier, faithfully advocating for the things that their constituents want. Instead, and it's particularly the case with Republican office holders, they're using these dog whistles to try and divide us. So I completely agree with you. We need political representatives that actually support the things that the people of this state and this country want.
It's culture war division, top to bottom. Obviously, I'm in the WOW counties. I speak with a lot of conservative voters, and we do agree on the vast majority of issues. They, in an ironic twist of fate, they vote by harm reduction in a similar way that I vote by harm reduction. You know, you're voting against whoever you hate more. Let's say you're voting for the lesser evil cycle after cycle after cycle.
Yeah, I agree.
Andrea, did you have another question?
Oh, no, that was great. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, Andrea. Let's go back to the phone lines. We got Kurt from Rhinelander. Kurt, what is your question for the professor today?
Yeah, professor, gentlemen, I got a question on the tax breaks. Is that just for the lower 38,000?
That's correct, Kurt. So the initial Republican proposal would have had for the budget would have had tax breaks or tax cuts for all four of the income tax brackets, and they would have actually merged four brackets into three, and so making them less progressive. I think at one point Republicans were even floating the idea of a flat tax, which, as we know, really, really hurts working people, because what that means is that the people who can afford to pay more, like millionaires and billionaires, aren't paying as much for all the public services that we all need and that they all profit from. So what Evers did is he used his line item power. I'm sure what he would have probably wanted to do was to extend some more tax relief to middle class people, but you know, he was kind of presented with a choice where he you know, would have had to have probably deprived the state of a lot of revenue and give significant tax increases to people making a relatively large amount of money. So he line itemed vetoed the two tax breaks for the top brackets. So you're correct, the tax breaks, which were pretty modest actually, will only apply to people making less than, as you noted, $35,000 a year or something like that. Yep. But this was really important. It was really important, I think, to veto, especially that top tax cut, because you're going to have like something like 10 or 20 millionaires each get $1.8 million in tax cuts, tax expenditure that we were going to pay for just forever, right? And so that would have been bad for, you know, the politics of our state, but certainly for the things that our state would need to fund moving forward.
Yeah, I was looking at, this tax percentage. Under 30,000, you pay practically nothing in income tax. And up to 100,000, it's close to 1,000, a yearly income tax. 200,000 is 3,500. 500,000, you're paying almost 70,000. You make $1 million, you're paying close to almost $110,000. So how does this benefit any middle class by no tax cut? We got a $6 billion surplus. Instead of giving the middle class at least $1,000 in a tax break, now they get absolutely nothing. then here we're talking about school tuition. I mean, it just, it makes absolutely no sense, because he's just bitter. The rich pay the highest percentage taxes to ADR. That's why when people retire in a state, they leave. And see, I just don't understand what the logic behind it is. That's why nobody stays in a state. You don't stay and retire if they move, because they don't want to pay the state income tax. And it was only going to drop it down by a minute percentage. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I hear what you're saying. The thing is, in terms of that, third bracket, you make an interesting point that maybe that could have been something that Evers considered a bit more. I think in terms of the top bracket, people aren't leaving the state when they're making over $1 million a year, right? Because of the slightly higher marginal tax increase. What I do agree with you is that we should do something to make it more likely for retirees to stay in this state, right? I do agree with you there, and I do think that's something that our legislators should probably be considering. I'm not an expert on that. But, you know, in terms of giving relief to middle-class people, I think there's other things that could have been done in this budget, like providing free school meals for, you know, all working parents, by, you know, doing something about childcare in this state, by making it more likely that workers could have a strong union. All those things would probably do a lot more than a tax cut. I'm not disagreeing with you necessarily, but I think there were a lot of ways this budget was lacking.
To give you some of the numbers as well, John, there were 11 filers in the state of Wisconsin with 75 million or more adjusted gross income. They would have received an average decrease of 1.8 million in tax reduction. The current tax rate is 7.65% for those individuals. It would have been cut to 6.5%. So to answer your question, Kurt, the ultra wealthy were getting the largest percentage of a tax cut as well. But because of the progressive tax code, you are getting that tax cut through every bracket. So technically, they're getting four tax cuts rather than an individual in the third bracket who's only getting 3, 2, 1, whatever, for example. Thank you so much for joining us today, Professor Shelton. This has been Office Hours with John Shelton. The professor will be in again. I can't give you an exact time or date for that, but if you have questions, comments, or concerns for the class, please feel free to share. Give us a call, 844-967-2789. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody.
Thanks, William. This land was made for you and me.